Good evening. My name is Alan Bernstein. I'm an alcoholic. Hi, and I'm delighted to be up here with you tonight. I want to welcome the new people and the out-of-towner and the Al-Anons. I want to thank Lee for inviting me to come up and speak. I was secretary of my home group about 2 years ago, and I had him come down to L.A., so I guess turnabout is fair play. And I've heard of this pocket of enthusiasm up in Santa Maria for a while, and it's really great to get up here and get to meet you all. And I had a lovely drive up, if you care. I brought my son with me. He's 14, and 14-year-old boys are supposed to be really obnoxious, but no one's given him the memo yet. And he's actually polite and good company, and he's over there playing foosball with one of the other guy's kids right now. And we were driving up, and he still sort of looks up to me, I think. And we're driving up, and he goes, "Dad, this is a long drive." I go, "Yeah, it is." You know, I'm thinking I'm being all humble driving for AA. And he goes, "Why are they having you speak?" And so I started to kind of explain that, you know, I'm like I'm an in-demand AA speaker. I don't know. And he's just looking at me like, "What?" You know, like. He humbled me. A little bit later, we were on the coast by the water, and Led Zeppelin came on playing Stairway to Heaven. And, I have to say this. I'm 28 years sober, and life in sobriety is good. I mean, driving on the California coast with my kid, Led Zeppelin blasting in our Honda Odyssey minivan. But, got to keep it real. I have to tell you, I don't have a perfect life, but I have regular moments in life where I'm reminded that I have done far better than I ever expected, and certainly than I ever deserved. I've been sober since April 16th of 1990. I got sober in New York City. They also bring their speakers up quickly, so Lee warned me that it comes up quickly. When Karen started reading how it works, I was cheering her on. I'm like, "Read it all, keep going." But I got sober in New York in April of 1990. I moved out to California in 1993 when I had 3.5 years of sobriety. My home group's the Pacific Group. We meet on Wednesday nights in Brentwood if you ever make it down that way. Please, come check us out. It's a big active meeting too. And Clancy is my sponsor. He's been my sponsor for almost 20 years. This July will be 20 years. And those are my facts, and I'm grateful for them. I don't mind talking. It's popular to sort of talk about how much you hate it. I don't mind it. But I have to confess, if I had known I was going to be spending 3 decades telling stories, I would have liked to have been paying more attention to them when they unfolded. I feel like it's all, a bit of a blur. And here's some facts. I was born in New York. I actually grew up in the Midwest. I'll get to that in a moment. But I was born in New York. I was born in Brooklyn. That was the edgiest thing I've done in my entire life. The entire street cred that I have, and I actually do get some street cred for it, was for the accident of being born in Brooklyn, New York. And my dad was in the Army. He had gone to West Point, and he was in the Army, and he did intelligence. And during the escalation in Vietnam, my mom sort of convinced him to go work for IBM, so he shifted into that. And we moved around a bit, and then we wound up in the Midwest. We wound up in Chicago in the suburbs when I was 10. I lived in a town called Elmhurst, Illinois. It's a leafy, lovely, green suburb of Chicago. There was a sign, it may still be there, when you drove into Chicago, to Elmhurst, that said, "Welcome to Elmhurst, a nice place to live." Like, very modest, very Midwestern and humble. I feel like here, everything would be like the capital of something, garlic capital of the world, artichoke capital of the world, the best city ever. But Elmhurst was nice, and Lombard was lovely, and Downers Grove was just dandy, and nothing much really ever happened. That, not entirely true. The Tylenol scare, when people got poisoned with Tylenol, that was Elmhurst. So there were those weird little moments, but mostly it was just a very lovely suburb. And the problem was me from the get-go. I was irritable and discontent and nervous and anxious from the get-go. And when we moved to Chicago, I had big, bushy red hair. I know, it's hard to, but I did, and I've got to tell you the truth. And I had an East Coast accent and a speech impediment. I was what we called back then a husky boy, meaning I was a little chubby. And as if I wasn't already self-obsessed enough, in the very German suburb of Elmhurst, there was a superstition. Some of you may be familiar with this, some of you may not be, but there was a superstition that rubbing a redhead would bring you good luck. So I am nervous and uncomfortable. I have bushy red hair. I talk funny. I am chunky. And random women in the Jewel are walking up to me and rubbing my hair. And I needed a drink. From back then, I needed a drink. And when I got to high school, my freshman year, we had a big musical. I went to a really big public high school. We had 3,500 kids in the school, and we did one big musical a year, and that year we did The Sound of Music, and I tried out, and later on I had more of a career in high school theater, but I did not get cast in that show. And later on, the director, who I got to know, explained very directly. He said, "You really weren't good enough for one of the substantial roles." He goes, "And you were the only Jewish kid to try out. And I felt really uncomfortable with the idea of casting you as a Nazi." And if you've ever seen The Sound of Music, oh, come on, it's The Sound of Music, folks. It's really, I've overcome greater injustices since then. I sat out The Sound of Music, but at the end of the show, a few of the girls kept their nuns' habits. And what we discovered immediately in those suburbs of Chicago, which were very German Catholic, Polish Catholic, Italian Catholic, Catholic, is that if you put a 16-year-old girl in a habit and smear a little bit of blush and lipstick on her and shove her into a package store, ain't nobody gonna card Sister Tiffany Brittany. And and we started getting booze that way. And we immediately went for heavy proof stuff. We were impact drinkers, and we were terrible bartenders. My recollection of how you make a high school screwdriver, for instance, is you find some like not too badly chipped Ronald McDonald Land glass. You put an ice cube in or two. You put like your Popoff or Smirnoff vodka, and then you basically just pass the dregs of some empty Tropicana carton over that, and you called it a screwdriver. And that was probably one of our better drinks. And we just from that point on kind of were insanely drunk as much as we could be. I spoke back home a few months ago. I was back home visiting family, and they had me speak in Naperville, which is not far away. And you know, it's funny how as I stay sober, parts of my story hit me in different ways. And I always used to joke about how much we drank and drove, because we did. We just there was no concept of cool parents, of cool homes. Like, nobody was gonna let you party in their rec room. We had to hide it. So we just, you know, drove to parks, drove around, drank in the car. And we were drunk, idiot high school kids driving around. And when I was speaking at that meeting in Naperville, and you know, my son's gonna be getting his learner's permit in like 7 months. And I just suddenly realized it wasn't very funny for those people that I had been driving that way for years. It was a long time ago, but I'm really fortunate that the story I have is just kind of a story of a goofy, miserable kid who got drunk a lot and you know, wasn't very nice, but I didn't take anybody out. And I'm overpaid, because I was on those roads drunk all the time. I drove a 66 Dodge Dart. It was my grandma's car. My grandma was huskier than me. Grandma was about 4'11" and shaped like a basketball. And when she got too big to drive, she gave me her car. And it was a 66 Dodge Dart. It didn't have heating or air conditioning. Part of the flooring had rusted out on the passenger side. We called it a beer drop. By the way, it's reasonably chilly here in Santa Maria tonight. Let me assure you, not having heating in the Midwest is kind of impactful in the winter. But I didn't grow up rich. That was the best car anyone had, and we drove it around all the time. And when I got too drunk to drive, somebody else would drive it. And again, I'm overpaid that I didn't cause more harm to other people. I did well in school. This is my story, and I got sober fairly young. In addition to being addicted to alcohol, I really was addicted to adrenaline. I can look back on my history and tell you that I was always uncomfortable with myself, and that anything that got me out of self was appealing. And so the way I went through my academic career was basically to be zoned out into the last possible moment, and then to be flooded with manic levels of adrenaline and just power through. And I just like being distracted. Any other reality to me is preferable. And I did reasonably well, and I had the opportunity to go off to school, and I went to school in North Carolina. North Carolina had a drinking age then of 19 for beer and wine, which was younger than Illinois, and I was 17 when I went to college, but nobody cared, and I fell madly in love with beer. I had a beer of choice. It was Budweiser. It's the king of beers. And I loved Bud Longnecks. We had hot, humid, summer-type nights a lot in North Carolina, and I loved drinking a Bud Longneck on a hot summer night. I liked the way the bottle would sweat a little bit. I like to peel the label off and then try to reattach it. It doesn't go back on, but if the room is spinning a little bit, the exercise and concentration helps. And and I think that when I hold a Bud Longneck in my hand, I feel more like the way that I think a man ought to feel. And like any guy who fantasizes that they're more of a man because of the drink they're holding, I was just a scared kid. I was a scared, lost, confused kid who was really uncomfortable. I joined a fraternity and then discovered the magic of pitchers and kegs. We had keggers all the time. And I'll tell you my favorite way of drinking is to have a big red plastic cup of beer. And basically, if we're doing it right, our friends are all sort of topping each other off all night long. And I have a credible claim of having one drink, because it's never quite hit the bottom, so it's a beer. And it might be 100 ounces, but it's a beer. And somehow or other, I power through college too. And I go to New York, I get a job in New York, and it's on. I got a job on Wall Street. It was the 80s. It's an era where it was a boom era on Wall Street, and they needed bodies. And I established very quickly that that's about all that I was going to be, was a body. I would show up late. I actually lacked basic skills that somehow or other you all seem to learn. Like, I would show up at 10:30 and just tell the truth. Like, why would you ever tell the truth when you're an active alcoholic showing up late to work? I'd just be like, sorry, I'm late. I was really hungover. And they would just kind of look at me like, you are not going to be competition. And they needed bodies. And at 5 o'clock, we were done, and I would get out of my little Brooks Brothers suit and into old ratty jeans and an old shirt, and start hitting the dive bars of New York. And I love dive bars. And I got to say this, it's not a requirement of membership in Alcoholics Anonymous that you like dive bars, but if you didn't like dive bars, I sort of want to know why, because they're heaven for someone of my type. They're dark and dingy, and it's a crowd of unsavory people. It's just everything like a good white suburban kid dreams of. And I just tore through all of them. I got sober in 1990, which means that, I got sober in the 90s, but it was the very beginning of the 90s. So I got sober with all of the 80s people, which meant there was a lot of bragging about how much cocaine people did. And occasionally, I don't know why, but the cocaine people always seemed to need to brag about how much they spent on it. It was really important to qualify like what the expenditure was. And one day I was bored and I sat down to figure out what I had spent on drinking in New York bars. And I'm like, they didn't spend as much as they think they did. I just spent all of my money on drinking. I would go to the Ukrainian bars and the Lithuanian bar, and there was the bar at 7th and B that was shaped like a horse. It had a horseshoe, and they had shot a scene in Crocodile Dundee in that bar. And there was a gas station at 2 and B that had been converted into a bar. And each one was just more magical than the last, as far as I was concerned. But here's what I can tell you about the progression of my alcoholism. Somehow or other, and it's mostly imperceptible for me when it's happening, the longer I drink, the more I find myself exhausted, the less energy I have. And what initially is an adventure begins to become a burden and then becomes completely overwhelming. And so truly, when I start going out in Manhattan, all I want to do is go everywhere. And I'm not somebody who drinks. I drink beer. I don't drink to get drunk really quickly. Whatever faith I lack when I got to the steps, I never lacked any faith that Anheuser-Busch was going to leave enough Budweiser on the island of Manhattan for me not to have to worry about them running out. And I loved devoting 6, 8, 10 hours, literally, to drinking. That was what I liked to do. And initially, I liked to go to different places, and then it became overwhelming. There were new places, new people. I might not know the bartender. I might not know how to navigate. I didn't want to deal with it. And so, imperceptibly, but increasingly, I got more tired, and my world got narrower and smaller. And for the last 2 years of my drinking, I basically moved into a dive bar called the Village Idiot. And it's not there anymore, but it was 11th and 1st, and it was a long, narrow, dark bar. There, I'm a suburban kid. I love urban glamour. There were junkies shooting up in the bathroom. There were parolees violating with concealed weapons. Fat Tommy was the bartender. As long as you tipped him occasionally, he didn't really care what you did. There was a jukebox with a lot of sad music on it, which I love. There was a lot of Patsy Cline. There was that Band of Gold song about the woman whose husband leaves her on their wedding night. And my favorite of all, Brandy, You're a Fine Girl. What a good wife you'd be. And they sold pictures, and I just moved in. I couldn't handle the world anymore. I could just sort of handle the idiot. I had that job. They didn't care that I was a drunk. And in some insane moment of integrity, I quit. Like only an alcoholic. I gave up that job and I became a cater waiter, and I didn't have a lot of money. And so here's what else I can tell you about my drinking and how powerlessness affected me. I knew going out that I didn't have enough money for my drinking every night. I knew that I wouldn't be able to not spend all the money. I would almost every night put a bus token in my pants, because the idea that the money would last through the night was not plausible. But I lived 30 blocks from that bar, and for some reason at 3 or 4 in the morning in New York, it's always raining. And when you're drunk and walking home 30 blocks at 3 in the morning, it's depressing. So I would put a bus token, because I would think, I know the money won't last, but it'll be hard to spend a bus token. And somehow or other, almost every night, I managed to get rid of that bus token. I would trade it for something, and it would be gone, and I would still be walking home. I hustle drinks, you know? When I got sober, you asked me to do an inventory. You showed me the 12 steps. You pointed out steps 4 and 5. And occasionally back then, I would meet people who were genuinely, like usually sort of in a funny way, shocked at the idea that they were expected to write an inventory and share it. But I wasn't, because I think anyone who's hustled drinks in dive bars understands the idea of looking at the goods you've got for sale and figuring out what's usable and what's not. And that was my trade. I needed to know what I had that could get you to buy me a drink. And I knew, and I resented the hell out of the fact that I was just not really great looking. Like, because in bars, there are always people who just want to drink with the most attractive people. And at least to my perception, that seemed like the easiest route, but that wasn't going to work for me. So I had to do two things to hustle drinks. One, I was really good at. And that was, I tell you really heartbreaking stories from my life. Now, if you haven't picked up on this, I'm a nice kid from the suburbs. My parents were married for 54 years. Like, we were raised with values. I had a bar mitzvah, and nothing bad really ever happened to me, but I feel it. So, like, I tell these stories, they're made up, but I feel it so deeply that I break your heart and you buy me a drink. That's the easier route. Although I have to say, I'm also like a good enough kid at my core that when I wake up the next day and remember the horrible manipulative lies that I've told to get drinks, the things that shouldn't happen to anyone that I claim have happened to me just to get people to be sympathetic, I need to drink the next day as well. And the other thing that's way more painful, with all affection for our Al-Anons here, is I learned quickly that in a dive bar, there's always somebody who needs to be heard. They need to tell you their story. They need to talk so badly and be heard so badly that they will gladly buy you a drink or two just to listen. And I can't even begin to claim that I care about other people. I don't care at all. Like, I'm not someone who counts my own drinks. I don't count your drinks. I don't do that. I'm self-obsessed from the get-go, but I will listen to your stories if you will buy me a drink. So that's what I do. I hustle drinks, and I sit there in the Village Idiot, and what happens is one night in February of 1990, for no discernible reason, after being drunk for about a decade, I suddenly have what I would call a moment of clarity. And it's a strange moment. In our book, one of our co-founders, Bill Wilson, talks about a white light experience. He talks about this idea of being in a room and suddenly being overwhelmed by the presence of a great light and the powerful sensation of the nearness of his creator. It's a paraphrase. By the way, I'm just going to say this right now. Our literature is great. Everything I say is going to be wildly paraphrased. It's my way of tricking you into going and actually reading what it says. And I have sort of the opposite. I have a dark light moment. That's literally what happens to me. I'm in this bar. It's already dark. It's a bar. I'm already drunk. And suddenly I have this overwhelming sense that the room, which is already dark, has gotten darker. And I have this sense that I have not had before of how isolated I am and how separated I am from the people. I see the physical space. Okay. I'm dying to know who's calling. I have this sense of the space between you and me. I see people who are holding hands, and in my mind, I see that their hands are not really connecting with each other. That's the impression that I have, is that there is just a separation of everyone from everyone, and certainly everyone from me. And I have a moment of clarity that I'm alone. And I've been drunk for years by this point, as much as I can be. But somehow or other, when I was drinking, I was able to push away the realization that I'm isolated, that my family is growing increasingly concerned. I haven't wound up in a situation where they can swoop in, but they're clearly circling around, looking at me with concern. And I don't know if anyone can relate to this or not, but this is just my experience. I'm actually really comfortable in an urban environment. I'm comfortable with the sense of a direct threat in front of me, but I am completely unarmed when you love me and you look at me with concern. I don't know what to do with that. It feels like a knife being shoved into me, even though the truth is it's just care. But it feels terrible because the truth is, I know that you're concerned, and I don't know how to explain that I can't do anything about what you're concerned about. And I get it, and I can't answer it, and I can't please you, and I just need to push you away. So I've pushed my family away, and I'm pushing my friends away, and I'm alone, but I've been able to drink my way into ignoring it, and now I can't. And I have that experience in one moment on one night in February of 1990, and it ruins my drinking. And I've done my best just now to explain it, but I don't actually have a logical explanation. And I've thought about it over the years a good amount, and I just have come to believe that it was the intervention of a loving God in my life. But it ruined my drinking, and I didn't know what to do. I had been willing to trade away everything in order to drink. I certainly had been willing to trade away my self-respect, my integrity. I'd been willing to move away from family and friends. It had been worth it in order to medicate my discomfort in the way that I knew how to. And now I couldn't even do that effectively. So I searched for an answer. I need to tell you, I certainly wasn't going to ask anybody for help. I don't believe in asking for help. I don't trust other people to help me. I just need to figure this out. I know that I need to figure it out. And I come up with the idea that I'm going to have two drinks a night, that I'm going to be a controlled drinker. And I set out to be a controlled drinker. From the laughter, I'm guessing I'm not the only one who's tried this experiment. Let's see if you relate to my experience. It's a nightmare. First of all, I drink to shut off the noise in my head, which is incessant. So what I like to do is to drink in loud bars. Anything that can drown out my head is what is my ally. So I still go to bars and I order a drink and I take a sip. But now I know that I have to wait 10 minutes before I can take my next sip. And so I'm waiting, and it's still a bar, so people are talking. But now I have a problem, which is I literally cannot focus enough to understand what you're saying. If anyone remembers the old Charlie Brown cartoons with the teacher, wah, 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 that is literally what it is like. You are talking, and I'm trying to remember how to nod and occasionally chuckle a little bit and just pray that it makes some sense with what you're saying, because I really cannot focus on anything other than how many more minutes are left until the 10 minutes are up and I can take my next sip. And finally, mercifully, 10 minutes are up and I take a sip, and the only thing that it does is it resets the clock for 10 more minutes, and it's a nightmare. And I make it 2 weeks in this experiment, and then mercifully, after 2 weeks, I wildly overshoot the mark one night, because I mean, controlled drinking, I feel like I wouldn't even wish it on an enemy. It's so awful, and I get really, really drunk, and the problem is it doesn't turn off my head. And, I have a belly full of booze, but my head is not shut down at all, and I'm lost, and I'm confused, and I feel betrayed by alcohol. And my next best idea is now a Mardi Gras is right around the corner. And I grew up in these very Catholic suburbs, and everyone I know gives up stuff for Lent. And so I decided in 1990 that for Lent, I'm going to give up drinking and any form of self-medication for Lent. Now, as I mentioned, with the bar mitzvah, I'm Jewish, and we don't do Lent. It's not our thing. Everyone's a little bit, back then, sort of like Alan Bernstein, giving up drinking for Lent, okay. But that's what I do. I give up Lent. I give up drinking for Lent, and I go crazy. I white-knuckle it through 40 days and 40 very long nights, and I am manic and bouncing off walls. And on Easter Sunday, I go dancing because I have so much energy. I have enough understanding now to suspect that if I had gone on much longer, I would have gone to the other side and gotten really, really depressed. But I was young. And for 40 days, I was sort of fueled by a manic energy and a dry drunk. And I wind up dancing in some club, and I meet somebody who's 2.5 years sober in Alcoholics Anonymous at 2:00 in the morning at a club called The Sound Factory in downtown New York. And in our literature, in the third step, which is about the idea that we need to have faith, we need to have a practice of faith, we need to make a decision to turn our will and our life over to the care of God. In the third step in the 12 and 12, it describes faith as a locked door for the newcomer. And it says that willingness is the key. And that if we have willingness, it's as if the door is magically opened. And I relate to that because that was my experience on that like Easter Sunday night. Somehow or other, I think that my fear about it, I'd heard of AA. I was not someone who didn't know about AA, but I just thought AA was so much the end of life. Like, just like as bad as it was, as painful as it was to be me, I believed AA was going to be worse. And meeting somebody out and about who seemed fun was like just a little spark of willingness to magically open that door. And that Sunday, Easter Sunday, I went to a meeting for the first time. And it was called High Noon, which, I mean, yay me for picking such a great place to surrender. And the speaker, I don't remember, but I ran into a gal, Alicia, and I'd known her from out and about, and she recognized me, and she took me out to a diner to talk after the meeting. And somewhere in her talking, I had a moment of identification. And I've thought back on this, and I don't know why anyone goes to their first AA meeting, but I got to tell you, I think I know why I went to my first AA meeting. I'm a victim, and I'm a good victim. And what makes me a good victim is it's not my fault. I mean well, I'm a decent person, I try my best, and the cards are just stacked against me, and so you should feel sorry for me. And it's important, if you want a lesson, here's a quick lesson on how to be a better victim. It's important to occasionally make a legitimate stab at making life better. So that when you try and fail for reasons beyond your control, you're more sympathetic. And I have no doubt that AA, for me, in April of 1990, was just one more thing that I could prove. You know, it was going to be therapy and life spring and whatever other things I'd done. Just something that somebody who's trying to make their life work better tries, and then it doesn't work out, and we can go back to feeling sorry for me. And certainly I can absolve myself that it just ain't my fault. But we're having this diner lunch after the meeting, and I have a moment where I identify with Alicia's description of her alcoholism. And at its core, that's my understanding of Alcoholics Anonymous. It's one alcoholic talking to another. It's these moments of identifications that we have. And my sincere belief all these years later is this. I do not believe that identification in Alcoholics Anonymous guarantees me physical sobriety. I think absolutely the application of the steps is critical, and then there's an element of it that is mysterious and goes beyond me. I don't think identification keeps me sober. I do believe, though, for whatever it's worth, that identification ruins any chance that I have of going back and enjoying my drinking. I think once I've identified an Alcoholics Anonymous, it's over. What I do with it is contingent on God, contingent on my actions, contingent on my willingness, but the likelihood that I get to enjoy my drinking is done. That being said, I didn't have that profound insight at that lunch, and Easter was over, and I had fulfilled my commitment to be sober for Lent, and so I went to a dinner up in Westchester County at a friend's parents' house for Easter supper, and I had half a glass of white wine and half a glass of red wine, and I guess I must have had some idea that I was going to try controlled drinking again. I don't really remember that part, but I only had half a glass of each. But what I remember distinctly and clearly, even all these years later, is standing at the train station by the tracks waiting for the train to bring us back into Manhattan. And I had half a glass of white and half a glass of red on me. And it was kindled. And I knew what the next indicated action was, just like you all do. The next indicated action was I was going to go back into Manhattan and get really, really drunk and stay that way for as long as I possibly could. I knew that. I could feel it on a cellular level. And in knowing that, I cannot tell you how exhausted I felt. The knowledge of what I had to do next had me so wiped out. Like I just felt ancient. And somehow or other, I went home and I went to bed. And the next day, I turned myself back into you. And that was April 16th of 1990. And one day at a time, since then, no matter what, I haven't picked up. That became my sobriety date. And I want to tell you a few things, especially because I know there are some new people here. I was not thrilled to be with you. Like, I didn't have some game plan to, like, you know, eventually be someone who was secretary of the Pacific Group and drove up to Santa Maria to speak for his friend Lee. Like, this was not my dream in April of 1990. I was confused. I was betrayed. I was angry. I was anxious. I thought you were lame. I thought I was lame for being here. I just thought everything was wrong and off. And yet I kept coming. And I'm going to tell you the quality that attracted me in Alcoholics Anonymous. It was the honesty. And I, you know, we were talking about this earlier, about the fact that every speaker, some people love a speaker, other people don't get that much from it. Meetings are the same way. Some people love a meeting, people don't. I think that there's a wide variety of experience in AA of how we interpret meetings, how we interpret speakers. But I have been here for a long time, and I've become convinced more and more that we all have really great BS detectors, and we know when somebody's telling us their truth, and we know when somebody's lying. We may not want to hear the truth, we may not want to hear the lie, whatever, but we know. And I went to those meetings, and they were telling the truth, and I'd been a barfly for the last few years. I'd lived in an environment where I lied all the time, where everyone around me lied all the time, when literally I could cite examples of times when it would have been easier to tell the truth, and it just felt so foreign on my tongue to tell the truth that I would still make up a lie. And then I come to AA, to these meetings, and these people, wherever they are in their experience, they're being honest about it. And I am fascinated. It strikes me as reckless and brave and utterly fascinating that these people are just getting up in front of strangers and telling the truth. And that they're not like exploding into flames and just leaving a pile of ashes. Like, the truth is not destroying them. Later on, I began to understand the truth actually will set me free. But literally in the early days, what impressed me was just that people telling the truth was clearly not destroying them, which is what I had convinced myself the truth would do. Now, I had a very practical problem when I got sober. I had gotten a bike 3 days before I got sober. And when I say a bike, I do not mean a cool vroom vroom Harley. I mean dun 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 dun, like a delivery boy bicycle. Dun 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 dun, dun that I rode around the island of Manhattan because they were out of clever nicknames. When I was a newcomer, they actually called me the boy on the bike. And I pedaled madly everywhere all the time. And in my first 5 weeks of sobriety, I had 6 accidents. And I got hit by a door, I got hit by a cab, I like ran into a pothole. I really gotta tell you, at least one time, I'm pretty sure I just spontaneously went over my own handlebars. And I just kept having bike accidents in the middle of Manhattan on my bike. And one of the problems that I had is that one of my favorite hobbies in early sobriety was to have loud arguments in my head. And I really like to fight with you, but I prefer to do it when you're not around. And I like to do it while I'm riding my bike. And the reason why I like to do it when you're not around is because even when I'm controlling the entire argument, you'd be surprised how often I start to lose the argument. And it gives me an opportunity to rewind and work out my like responses so I can dominate the argument in my head with you. And so I pedal and I argue and I don't wear a helmet because I'm in my mind a tough guy and helmets are for wusses, and I get hit by things. And that's my first 5 weeks of sobriety. And at 5 weeks of sobriety, this was the first indication for me of the magic of Alcoholics Anonymous, because I'm biking down 2nd Avenue in the upper 30s. I'm running late to a meeting. As a side note, I don't understand. I was this newcomer, and now I still don't understand why a newcomer like me, who literally had nothing going on, could never get anywhere on time. If you want to know how, newcomers, if you want to know how to trick your sponsor into thinking you've got your act together, show up on time. They will think they've got their act together more. Like that's there. Take that away. I'm biking down 2nd Avenue, I'm cutting west. This is where, in the upper 30s, all the traffic cuts east for the Midtown Tunnel. So me, dun-dun-dun-dun-dun, no helmet, arguing with Mary Ministeri that day, I happen to remember, I'm biking to the west, and the buses and trucks, like literally trucks and cars, are all merging east against me, and I'm not paying any attention. I'm just driving, biking around, and I suddenly have a moment of clarity, and the moment of clarity amounts to this: I don't care. I don't care. That's my problem. And in our book, it describes the dilemma of the real alcoholic as who arrives in AA as having to make a choice between certain physical death and living life on spiritual terms. And maybe the Al-Anons can fill me in later about this, because I always humor myself by thinking that that's the section where the person who loves an alcoholic but who's not an alcoholic just gives up. Like, they read that and they like get their highlighter out, and I'll explain why in a moment, like, and they like mark it up and they call their sponsor and they go, wait, what this is saying is that an alcoholic, given a choice between letting God be active in their life and dying, can't make up their mind. Like, that's a dilemma for the newcomer. And like, you know, God in your life or death, and I need to get back to you on that on Thursday. And and yet, that's exactly who I was. I didn't care. I enjoyed your honesty. I ate your cookies. I showed up. But I really didn't care what happened to me. I was really tired. I wasn't really optimistic that any of it was going to work for me. I felt like I was damaged more profoundly than you were. I just felt like there was something flawed in me that wasn't going to ever get better. And I didn't care. And what I wanted when I biked around Manhattan was for the traffic of Manhattan to do for me what I was unable to do for myself. And at 5 weeks, I understood that in a moment. And what I also understood was that if I kept on biking the way that I was biking, I was going to get my wish. And here's what I realized in that moment. And it was so, I have to tell you, it was so minimal and yet so profound. I was not in that moment filled with an overwhelming sense of the glory of God. I was not filled with gratitude at this vision of my unborn children and the beauty of a drive up the coast. That did not happen. But what did happen was I suddenly realized that it wasn't quite 50-50, whether I lived or whether I got sober or died. It was maybe like 51-49 in favor of you guys. It was an almost imperceptible shift, but I couldn't truly say in that moment, I didn't care. And up until that moment, I didn't care. And here's what I did next. I pedaled down to 12th Street and I bought myself a helmet. I did. And I immediately stopped having accidents. And for whatever it's worth, this has been my experience. This is a program of action in my experience. My intentions are always good, even when they're bad. But my actions, when they're good, I get good results. And my experience with prayer, and I love our 11 step, I try on a daily basis to improve my contact with God through prayer and through meditation. But if I can tie my prayer to an action, somehow or other, my prayers seem to get answered more rapidly. And I bought a helmet because I had this idea that maybe I didn't care. Maybe I did care if I died. Maybe a little. And I think that helmet was a prayer to care a little bit more. And I stopped having accidents. I got active in AA, I did commitments, I did the steps. I did the stupidest fifth step ever. Like I was at a meeting. Things were a little bit different. By the way, I mean, if you're here and this is your experience, this is gonna seem like the only way people do it. My experience over the years traveling around AA, the flavor is a little different wherever you go. I think the language of the heart is the same, but it's all a little bit different. New York wasn't as rigid on sponsorship back then. It wasn't as rigid on working the steps. I was floundering. I went to a Sunday night meeting. I talked about being lost and confused and not familiar with these steps. And this woman who had met me grabbed me and she bossed me around into riding a four-step. She was a vixen on a soap opera. She was playing the vixen on a soap opera. She was blonde and had blue eyes. She had hands down in 1990 the best rack in Alcoholics Anonymous. And I mean, I'm gay, but like there's power there. And and she sort of demanded that I ride a four-step. And I mean, I was so confused as a newcomer. I didn't understand up and down. And I think in my mind, I thought it was some secret celebrity outreach program. Like I was gonna get a friend who's a celebrity and I'm like, okay, I'll write an inventory. But here's the thing, I wrote the inventory. I had no good reason for doing it, but I did it. And my experience is God does not care about my alcoholic motivations. He cares about my actions. And I wrote a sincere inventory and I read it. And it was so petty. I lived a lie of life, lies and secrets. I grew up in a home with a dad who did Army intelligence. Nobody ever told anyone anything in my house. Information was knowledge and power and you sequestered it. And half of my inventory resentments were resenting people for not returning my phone calls. This is for you younger people, this is before like cell phones and text messaging didn't exist yet. Like, people just didn't return calls all the time, but I assumed it was always a secret language. I knew that there was some deep meaning. It wasn't just that you were busy or forgetful or self-obsessed. Like, you were telling me that you had figured out something about me that I was trying to keep hidden, and I resented you for not returning my phone calls. And I have to say, when I saw the pattern, I was able to let go of it, and that's part of, to me, the beauty of the steps, is when I see in the individual resentments, I'm lost. But when I can see the pattern of how my self-centeredness and self-obsession warps me into making things much bigger deals than they really are, I can let go of them a lot of the time. I moved out to California when I was 3.5 years sober, and I landed badly. I had actually grown comfortable in sobriety in New York, and I came out to LA looking for work, and I just sort of thought I had it all going on, and I came out to California, where in LA they don't care how you do it in New York, and they, you know, I joke sometimes. I arrived in late October, and I think they had a quota for popular people, and they'd already filled it that year, and I got angry and resentful, and they wanted me to know names. They wanted me to know who Chuck was, and who Clancy was, and who Johnny was, and so on and so forth. And I'm like, I don't, like, give me a cheat sheet or don't expect me to know these names, and Clancy would sneeze on someone and you'd get a 5-minute dissertation on how profound Clancy's sneeze was and how it had changed their life. And I'm like, I gave you a ride to the meeting, talk about me. And I was so petty. And I used it as an excuse to sort of move away from AA for a little while. And we have a lot of lifeboat imagery in our literature, and I relate to it. And I was on the lifeboat, but in my experience, the place where I want to be is in the center of the lifeboat. And I chose to move to the edge of the lifeboat through my own actions, through my own ego, through my own pettiness. And on the edge of the lifeboat is where people get swept overboard a lot more, and that's who I was hanging out with. And at a certain point, I knew that I was in trouble. 7, 8 years of sobriety, I knew I was in trouble. And here's the truth. It occurred to me that I was happier when I was in the middle of the lifeboat, and that I wanted to get back to the middle of the lifeboat. And I kid you not, I had no idea where the middle of the lifeboat was. And look, obviously, I'm not lacking in education or analytical capabilities. It had nothing to do with that. I'm an alcoholic, and when I get off the beam, there's not a guarantee that I get back on the beam. And I was lost. And my great good fortune, in case you should ever find yourself lost in the middle of sobriety, I'm gonna tell you what my great good fortune was. First of all, I had the sense to share about it, which is not always my inclination. A lot of times when I'm in the middle of something, what I want to do is resolve it before I tell you about it, so I can sort of present it in a package with wrapping and a little bow. And I shared about being lost. And somebody who I knew I mean, they just let, they didn't let me have it in a mean way. They just let me have it. They go, I believe you. I believe you're going to get loaded. But you're 8 years sober. Have you not ever noticed that everyone with 8 years sober who gets loaded comes back? He goes, they don't all stay back, but they all come back. So if you're getting ready to be a newcomer anyway, why don't you just start acting like a newcomer now? I know, it's very insensitive of him. And he saved my life. I had a sponsor, but my sponsor had moved to Europe. And this is really before email still. And I used to have a home group. When I was more enthusiastic about sobriety, I had a home group like this, a regular place where I could show up and be accountable. And I switched into what I call geographic sobriety. I went to meetings in Hollywood and West Hollywood. That meant that you could sort of define the zip codes that you were likely to find me in, but good luck having any idea what time or where. Mm-hmm. And I wasn't really working with people. And so I went over to the Pacific group because it was just a big active group and because I was out of ideas. And I lurked around there for a little while, and then it occurred to me that I needed a sponsor, and I was 9 years sober by that point. And I thought, I'm not doing well. I thought if I make it to double digit sobriety and I'm even slightly enthusiastic for being sober, I'll be doing a lot better than I am right now. And I noticed that Clancy sponsored a lot of people who had double digit sobriety who seemed to be excited about being sober. And you know, here in California, we're so lucky, in my opinion, so lucky to have people who have been doing this a long time and are still on fire for it. And I thought he's really bossy, and I'm not sure how I'm going to put up with that, but he's effective at working with people who are staying sober longer than me and like being sober. And if I can get back to that, I'll be better. And so I asked him to take on my case. And I went down to see him in July, and I had a goatee. And I actually don't have strong opinions about facial hair, but Clancy is known for not liking facial hair on the guys he sponsors. So I cleverly kept my goatee on so that when he asked me to shave it off, I could agree. Like, you know, I was lost, but not an idiot. And I think he did ask if I would do that. And I think my mistake was that I agreed too readily. I think I should have fought it a little bit more before I agreed. And I think I agreed too readily. And he looked me up and down. He said later on, it was July, and I was so pale that I looked like a vampire. He goes, kid, it's good to be out in the sunlight enjoying life. Why don't you come to the yard? And the yard is this thing in the Pacific Group on Saturdays where we get together and the guys play some softball while the girls are playing some volleyball, and then we get together and have some lunch and play some more volleyball. And if you're any kind of an athlete, it is as absolutely benign as it sounds. But I was terrified of softball, and it was insanely intimidating. It was a year before I got a hit of that ball, and I would watch newcomers roll out of detox trucks and hit triples, and I wish them pain. And I was lost, but I was lost, and I just kept showing up and trudging through. And at some point, they asked me to talk to this guy, Tom. Tom Wilson was an old timer. He's gone now, but he was an old timer in our group, who had for many years coached the women's softball team. But Tom's gift was he was known as a person who could sort of talk people through their anxiety about the yard. And and I was miserable and lost. And I knew that I had a sense, and I think I was actually right, that Clancy was looking for an excuse to fire me. I don't think he particularly wanted to take me on, but you know, he's a good AA and he agreed to. And so I knew I had to do it, and I felt like I couldn't do it. But I knew that I couldn't talk to Tom. Tom had advanced diabetes, and he had had his legs amputated. And if I have failed to convince you in the last 45 minutes, 50 minutes, let me assure you, I am capable of feats of great self-obsession. But even as capable as I am of self-obsession, the idea of going to whine to a man who didn't have legs about my fears of playing softball That was beyond my capability. I couldn't do it. And the old timers who surrounded me said, you've got to go talk to him. Tom is good at this, and you don't have a plan B, and you're going to lose Clancy if you can't do this yard thing. You've got to go talk to Tom. So I sucked it up, and I went to talk to Tom. And Tom had some good advice, really good advice. He just said, Alan, the yard is great for the guys who enjoy it, but it transforms the people who don't. Walking through fear is what transforms us in Alcoholics Anonymous. For the other people, it's just a fun day, but you do it and it'll change your life. But the more profound thing that happened in that conversation was that I had a flicker of recognition. Tom was a man with real problems, and he lives on a second floor apartment. I knew him because we were bringing a meeting to his house, because until he got fitted with his fake legs, he couldn't even get out of his apartment because they didn't have an elevator in the building. I mean, he had real problems. And I brought an alcoholic problem to him that he knew something about. And I recognized when he was talking to me that there was a moment where he was actually able to get out of self and that he felt better for doing that. And that's what I had forgotten. In that interim period where I got angry at AA, I forgot that what AA really is at its core is a program that allows somebody like me, who suffers from crippling self-obsession, that if I don't do something about it, will eventually become so overwhelming that I have to drink to relieve that self-obsession. It gives somebody like me an opportunity to practice being useful to God and God's kids. And if I make a habit of being useful to God and God's kids, I get to get out of self. And I get to build one day at a time a good life. I get to build a life where in my Honda Odyssey, I get to drive up the coast with one of my children and have a lovely day and have dinner with you people and have a sense that I'll get to go to bed tonight feeling good about myself and about my place in the world. That's what Tom gave me in that conversation. I want to say this. Tom didn't live a lot longer after that, but before he died, he got his legs. And he was able to take one last cake at our meeting. And if you've never been to our Wednesday night meeting, we hold it in a big synagogue. And when you take your cake, you walk down, and then you walk up some stairs to the dais, or bima, as it's called, and you say a few words of gratitude. And Tom had been fitted with his legs. And Clancy gave him his cake. And then Tom, under his own power, was able to walk up those stairs and express his gratitude for AA and for the life that he found in our home group and in Alcoholics Anonymous. And I was so moved because I realized I was seeing a miracle. I was literally seeing a man without legs get up and walk in Alcoholics Anonymous. And this is what I've come to understand. God doesn't exist because I'm sober. Doesn't work that way. Whatever God is, whatever you understand it to be, whatever I understand it to be, that's here. It's infinite and all-knowing, and it's there. But when I'm an alcoholic lost in my cups, when I am in the midst of my disease, I don't have any contact with that. I don't have any sense of how miraculous and wonderful life is. And what AA gives me is an opportunity to get a sense of how magical life can be. I would love to end on a joke. My daughters were, I have three children. I have my son who's here and two daughters. And my daughters were bat mitzvahed about 3 weeks ago. And in doing that, you put a photo montage together. And it was literally an opportunity to sort of look through the last like 15 years of my life. And this is my wish for all of us. You know, I looked through it and I realized that on a day-to-day basis, I still have alcoholism. I still wake up convinced that I have problems that are insurmountable. I wake up with a frequent instinct that everything has gone off the rails and is going wrong. But what AA has allowed me to do is sort of course correct on a daily basis, to be useful, to be a part of life. And the rewards and the payback have been unbelievable. I'm so grateful for the life that I have. And especially if you're new, I want to end with this. I really hope you can relate to the fact that when I got here, I believed in AA, but I knew it wouldn't work for me. I just knew it. I knew that you were having something happening in your lives, and it was lovely. You were nice people. I was glad for you. I knew it wasn't going to happen for me. But what the people who got to me in those early days did was they convinced me to take the actions that they were taking, to take the actions of someone who believed in AA, even though I didn't. And it turns out to be utterly unimportant whether I believe in AA. What matters is that I do AA. And you've taught me that. And if I can offer that back to anybody, I'm so grateful, because when I do AA, I have a chance of having a really wonderful life. And I'm grateful for that. Thank you.